It's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Marty Natalegawa to CSIS for the CSIS Pernamena Banyan Tree Leadership Forum. Dr. Marty Natalegawa is the former foreign minister of Indonesia. And it's always a pleasure to welcome Dr. Natalegawa here, but I'm especially pleased that today we get to hear his views on a very important topic of great interest here in Washington, which is ASEAN. And in particular, Dr. Natalegawa is going to talk about the book that he just published, Does ASEAN Matter? A question that is frequently asked here in Washington. And there are copies of the book for sale in the back of the room. In recent years, Washington has recognized the need to deepen ties with Southeast Asia and with Washington, but it's not always a straightforward effort. And so I'm really grateful for the contribution that Dr. Natalegawa has made, certainly to ASEAN itself and to the debate over the role of ASEAN and how the U.S. can most fruitfully engage and how we can understand ASEAN a little bit better. As anyone who knows Indonesia or Southeast Asia will tell you, Dr. Natalegawa is quite clearly one of the most important and influential figures in the history of Indonesian foreign policy and ASEAN affairs. He served as foreign minister of the Republic of Indonesia from 2009 to 2014, and he currently serves as a member of the UN Secretary General's High-Level Advisory Board on Mediation. He began his career with the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1986, and along the way, he served as Director General for ASEAN Cooperation and spokesperson of the Department of Affairs, as ambassador to the Court of St. James in Ireland, and permanent representative of Indonesia to the UN in New York. He earned his doctorate in philosophy from the Australian National University and a Master of Philosophy degree from the University of Cambridge. So with that, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Natalegawa to give remarks, and we will follow with a discussion and have time for a question and answer session with the audience. Marty?
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Amy, for welcoming me and for your introductory remarks just now. I think all of us, irrespective of our nationalities, given the events over the past few days in Indonesia, the earthquake and the tsunami that has struck the island of Sulawesi, we must express our sense of sympathy and condolences, and especially the tremendous outpouring of support by many, including here in the United States, to what is happening in Indonesia. And I should like to begin by expressing our the common sense of sympathy that we all feel. Thank you, Amy, for having me this morning at the CSIS. Tremendous forum, platform, all these years in providing thought leadership on matters to do with our region, Southeast Asia, ASEAN, and especially to keep the interest alive here in Washington, in particular on a region that is often not obtaining the full the type of attention that I believe that it deserves. This morning, I should like to talk a little bit and hopefully have more discussions with you and with colleagues in this room. On the central issue of does ASEAN matter? I think the fact that my book posed the nature of the issue as a question rather than a statement is a deliberate one, because I wish not to simply have a sense of celebratory sentiment about ASEAN's its achievements, but in a more frank and hopefully candid manner to pose the question, does ASEAN matter and how it has mattered in the past? Because I have been very much part of the ASEAN's work, and therefore I try as much as possible to detach myself and to have a bit more candid and honest consideration. At the risk of caricature. Upon further reflections, I came to recognize there have been at least three types of three ways in which ASEAN has mattered in the past. The first one is basically in transforming the nature of the relations between countries of Southeast Asia, because prior to ASEAN, prior to 1967, countries of Southeast Asia, they were not only were relations marked by tensions and animosities, but in many cases, in some cases, marked by open conflict among them prior to ASEAN. Strategic trust now has replaced trust deficit thanks to ASEAN. Among the countries of Southeast Asia now, there is a degree of trust and confidence hitherto absent prior to ASEAN. The notion of open conflict among us, among countries of Southeast Asia, has now been set aside. Mm-hmm. And this is quite a transformative change, mm-hmm. Given what existed before 1967. The second type of transformation that I wanted to flag is in terms of the position of countries of Southeast Asia within the wider region of Asia Pacific. Mm-hmm. Prior to ASEAN, Southeast Asia was marked by proxy and even direct superpower rivalries in our region, where countries of Southeast Asia were either in one side of the East-West divide or the other. And there was like a sense of perfect storm in our region, where not only were there regional disputes and animosities, but those type of animosities have been further worsened and deepened and sharpened by major power rivalries as well. ASEAN changed all that, because through ASEAN, we've seen the centrality of ASEAN member states collectively becoming consolidated, ASEAN in the driving seat role in a way. We have seen how most of the region's architecture have been initiated by ASEAN, have been made possible by ASEAN, and truly ASEAN has become central in the region's discourse and the region's developments. And not least, and the third point that I wanted to identify, is how ASEAN has made possible a more people-centric efforts in our region. Of course, initially, ASEAN as an entity was a very state-centric in its outlook. And of course, concepts such as state sovereignty and non-interference is very much inherent to ASEAN's way of thinking. But over the years, we have seen clear manifestation of a people-centered ASEAN through the economic transformation that ASEAN has made possible. The economies of Southeast Asia were at one time obviously difficult conditions and state, and now ASEAN economies, whenever they are mentioned, is always in the sense of how vibrant and dynamic and how millions of people have been lifted out of poverty in our region, et cetera, et cetera. But not only in terms of economic betterment by people-centered ASEAN, although this is very much a work in progress, is the governance issue. We have seen increasingly since 2003, 2005, through the ASEAN political security community, the notion of having a region-wide common voice and common thoughts on governance, on human rights, democratization. Of course, this is very much a subject that is still ongoing. It's becoming more and more prominent. In other words, ASEAN, 5 decades of ASEAN plus, transformative in at least those three areas. But the point that I was trying to make in my book is that more of the same by ASEAN would not suffice. The type of assets and the type of qualities that ASEAN enjoyed in the past 5 decades may not be of relevance in the future, in the immediate future as well. Take the intra-Southeast Asia relationship. Although now we speak of ASEAN community, and the fact that, as I said before, relationship among ASEAN Southeast Asian countries have been transformed. Instruments such as the TAC, non-use of force among ASEAN countries, the ASEAN 10, the ASEAN community, those have been extremely important in changing the dynamics of relationship among the Southeast Asian countries. But I detect the risk of complacency among ASEAN countries, where the camaraderie and the so-called ASEAN way that have been very much prevalent in the past may become dissipated in the current time, when differences among ASEAN countries have become more pronounced than in the past. Disagreements have not been unique in the past. We've had difficult episodes in 2012, for example, on the South China Sea. But in the past, whenever disagreements or disputes and divisions occur, at least there was a sense of agitation that this is not proper, and there was a serious effort to restore a sense of unity. But now it seems to me division is becoming increasingly accepted, in a way even manifested in formal documents, where ASEAN documents no longer speak of ASEAN as a collective entity, but simply recording the position of one country is such and the other country is the other way. So the intra-Southeast Asian relationship, there could be a sense of drift unless properly reinvested in efforts. An a la carte regionalism, where we have a paradox of plenty, we have so many instruments and possibilities, and yet reticence to actually employ them. Because we have now a whole, many choices of instruments within ASEAN, whether it be to deal with within country situation or between countries. And yet, in most cases, those instruments have remained dormant. They have not been utilized. There have been a few exceptions. When Thailand-Cambodia border incidents occurred in 2011, there was an ASEAN effort, but that required a deliberate and purposeful effort to actually utilize those instruments. The second point, ASEAN in the wider region, how can ASEAN go beyond convening power? ASEAN is tremendously successful and efficient in organizing events, and no one does events better than ASEAN. We have wonderful events and camaraderie and efficiency. But when we reflect on matters in terms of substance, where are we? Are we having footprint on developments on North Korea, for instance, on the Indo-Pacific, a subject matter that I spoke here back in 2013? The need for ASEAN to have a view on Indo-Pacific is only when now President Trump began to speak of it last October 2017 that ASEAN is scrambling once again for a position that they actually began to have 2013, but they chose to set in abeyance. They chose to have a pause. But in a fast-changing world, if you pause, you'll be left behind. So I think ASEAN must have a script. They must come up with ideas. There is no monopoly of wisdom, but we have to proceed beyond organizing events. Just to take the example of North Korea once again. In 2017, I remember, around April, the foreign minister of North Korea actually wrote to the Secretary General of ASEAN to have some kind of ASEAN discourse on the subject matter. This was before the Manila summit. But then the ASEAN member states chose to let the moment pass, and then things happen, as we are, fortunately, positive things happen. But we are not really in it. We are not actually influencing and shaping events. Thankfully, Singapore, as chair of ASEAN, has been extremely proactive and active. And the Singapore summit will always reflect ASEAN's, in a way, ASEAN's relevance. But we need to do more in terms of the geopolitical contributions. And last and not least, on the people-centered ASEAN, this is, I think, is the most problematic one as far as I'm concerned, not the material economic one, but the more governance issues, human rights, democratization, a sense of drift unless properly given a proper push and encouragement. But we have been aware all from the very beginning that on this pillar, on the political security pillar, there is a great need for hand-holding and positive encouragement, the establishment of state practice. Indonesia have been extremely instrumental in the past in establishing these state practices, but in the absence of such a continued engagement and encouragement, there could be a reversal of dynamics in our region. But having said all that, actually doubts about ASEAN's efficacy, about ASEAN's relevance have been perennial. We've had this on many, many moments in the past when questions have been asked of ASEAN's relevance, and yet ASEAN has proven its resilience, its relevance, and I have every confidence that will be the case as well today and in the immediate future. But for that to happen, we need to have an ASEAN member states that is proactive, transformative, united in their outlook, and to recognize that there is there is a risk of complacency, a risk of taking things as they are, and therefore reducing its relevance. Those are some of the thoughts that I wanted to share, Dr. Sirirat, at this moment, and I'm looking forward to our discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Nalagawa. I have to commend this book to the audience to read. It's really a wonderful read and lays out your arguments that you shared with us now, your insights very clearly. Mm-hmm. And what really makes the book special is the degree to which you can go through several cases of what I would call ASEAN successes and ASEAN failures or challenges that were not yet quite met, with a degree of detail and insight that comes from the fact that you worked on so many of them directly. So just to recap for the audience, some of the successes that you point to, successes is my word, I'm not sure you use that word, but the kind of ASEAN successes you point to include the expansion of ASEAN to include Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and Myanmar, the intervention, that the mediation that Indonesia was able to provide on behalf of ASEAN, as chair to ASEAN, between the Thai-Cambodia dispute over the Priya Vihear temple area, dealing with Myanmar's transition to democracy and having ASEAN provide a unified front in the international community supporting Myanmar's efforts to reform and giving Myanmar space to go forward with that process. And the earlier chapters of the South China Sea issues when ASEAN came to real consensus in putting out its own declaration on conduct in the South China Sea before, you know, and then engage China on that basis. The less successful episodes that you kind of go into some detail on include the later chapters of the South China Sea, including the famous year in when Cambodia was chair, when ASEAN failed to come up with a unified position and sort of subsequent struggles around that, and the Rohingya crisis, and the recent difficulty of ASEAN to be able to pose a united front to the international community when Malaysia broke ranks and did not agree to come to, or disassociated itself with the chairman's statement on the Rohingya, and the kind of public division within ASEAN that was shown, and some other less successful things as well. But I guess there's one observation from that really interesting list. I mean, we could think a lot about kind of lessons to draw from the individual cases, but you were so directly involved in so many of them, so it's to your great credit that many of the success stories played out the way they did. But it was also Indonesia's role. I mean, you were, you know, foreign minister or other roles within the foreign ministry of Indonesia. And, you know, when you or your senior leadership had ideas, you would go to the president of Indonesia, whoever that was at the time, and get their full support and really forge ahead with some very creative ideas that kind of kept ASEAN in many cases on a positive trajectory of transformation and evolution. We don't see that much today. I think, you know, you talk about cooperative leadership as being a transformational outlook, and having cooperative leadership among leaders being real key ingredients for ASEAN to have a successful future. And I guess the question that we struggle with is, you know, how do we get that? I mean, aside from hopefully leaders reading your book and coming away with some insights, if Indonesia is not playing quite the same role that it has traditionally, other countries in the region tend to are inward looking. There's a lot of kind of populist dynamics in many countries. that are leading to somewhat of an inward look rather than an outward look about how to push ASEAN forward. You know, what can we do to try to incentivize or create that kind of, you know, inducement for that kind of leadership to come to the fore?
Well, I do believe that the one of the central challenges that ASEAN is facing, not just ASEAN, actually in general, foreign policy makers and foreign policy practitioners, one of the challenges that we face nowadays is how do we synergize the domestic and internal and external nexus, the link between domestic and the external, to set aside the impressions or the suggestion as if one can only do one thing at a time, that there is a priority, a domestic priority, over external engagement, as if they are either or in their nature. And foreign policy makers and foreign policy practitioners must come up with some, you know, smart ideas that to suggest that these are actually consistent and they're actually complementary in nature. By way of example, when Indonesia went through the 1998-1999 onwards reformasi process, we were obviously very much internally consumed. We had all kind of so-called multi-dimensional crisis. And there was a really strong constituency within Indonesia that suggests, even from the civil society in Indonesia, that suggests let's switch off our foreign policy. Let's focus on our internal massive problems that we were having. But then the foreign ministry at the time actually made the counter-argument that precisely because we were having so much internal difficulties, we need to have a benign external environment. Mm-hmm. And the only way to ensure that is to be taking a proactive role. Hence, at the time, we introduced the notion of ASEAN political security community, to ensure that the changes that Indonesia is going through in terms of reform and democratization goes hand in hand with the broader dynamics in our region, to promote synergy and to ensure that there is not an either or proposition. And but that takes a great deal of hand holding, a great deal of convincing by the foreign ministry, to be honest, in Indonesia to the wider domestic national setting. Once we begin to go into the line of thinking that this is an either or, the domestication of foreign policy. I mean, foreign policy is obviously always must be anchored by domestic concerns and considerations. It has to be relevant. It has to bring direct benefits to the country as a whole. But once you have a domestication of foreign policy, as if foreign policy or ASEAN in this case is only looked at in terms of its immediate transactional impact on you know, ourselves, then our ambitions become somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. So we have been in the past making the point that this is actually complementary. Hence, we had the Bali Concord II, synergizing domestic and the region. And Bali Concord III, when we speak of ASEAN in the global community of nations, at the time in 2011, was in response to the nexus between the region and the globe, the global level. There was a school of thought, and there is still a school of thought in Indonesia that speak of ASEAN as a pillar rather than the pillar of Indonesian foreign policy. And they say we have to do the world rather than ASEAN. But we said, look, you can whistle and walk at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's why we suggest that ASEAN itself, we bring ASEAN with us. ASEAN has a common view on global issues, so there is not an either or. But this requires a lot of heft, a lot of a sense of resilience and persistence. But if we don't, then we will be where we will be. Yeah. Mm. So I think it's a common challenge nowadays. I think it's not uniquely Indonesian, how we manage the nexus, the link between domestic and external. Mm-hmm. I thought, to be honest, ASEAN had got it just right already, to be honest. I thought 2015 ASEAN community, we got it spot on, a nice balance there between non-intervention, etc., and common concern. But I think we are losing, in a way, the equilibrium is being disrupted. And now as if it's back to the 80s and 90s mindset of either we intervene fully or we desist fully. When there is actually a third way which we have crafted, but somehow it's been set in abeyance. But it is a common challenge, a running challenge, I think, for ASEAN.
Let me turn to this transformational outlook that you also point to as being so necessary for ASEAN to remain successful and to move forward. You noted in your remarks, I'm glad you brought it up, and it's also in the book, your frustration with the fact that there was discussion within ASEAN about having an ASEAN view on an Indo-Pacific, kind of a treaty of the Indo-Pacific that would bring a kind of normative framework that other countries would sign on to in a similar fashion to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, that would be broad, you know, a broad Indo-Pacific vision, which of course now has been usurped to some degree by other powers who have put out their visions of free and open Indo-Pacific and similar kind of views. Indo-Pacific has become very much the currency of regionalism these days. As a reaction to that, a response to that, ASEAN is now taking a look again at whether there can be an ASEAN vision for an Indo-Pacific. And Indonesia was asked to take the pen on a draft. I haven't seen the draft. I don't know if you have. But I understand from talking to some other Indonesian diplomats that that there's a lively debate going on within Indonesia and perhaps more broadly within ASEAN about what that vision should look like, whether it should be norms-based or more transactional, although I'm not clear on what the transactional approach would look like. But given your history with this concept, I wonder if you could share your views on what you think, any insights you have about where this might be headed for ASEAN and what impact it might have if there is a consensus on some kind of a document and vision, but and your views of what it should look like.
What concerned me at the moment is that when we speak of Indo-Pacific, within ASEAN, at least from what I gather, it tends to become quite procedural, mechanical almost, describing geography rather than speaking of the geopolitics of this domain that we speak of. You know, people pondering and wondering who would be in and who would be out, and what will be the issues to be discussed, maritime issues, connectivity, perhaps SDG, perhaps. But then there's not an honest thinking through of what are the problems and the opportunities in this Indo-Pacific space. But the first point, I think ASEAN must assert and reassert, is the point that this is not new for us. Because the East Asia Summit 2003-2005, when we included from the very beginning India, Australia, and New Zealand, the debate has been had, and then we already have a conclusion. By having those countries in the East Asia Summit, we are already saying ASEAN's outlook is Indo-Pacific in its outlook, and not purely East Asia, or Asia-Pacific even. So Indo-Pacific has been inbuilt within ASEAN, and when we had the United States join and Russia join in 2011, that further manifests and strengthened the Indo-Pacific outlook. But then we need to deliver in terms of its content. You know, I mean, what we've done basically is create the tent under which all these countries now belong. But then we need to give flesh, we need to give substance to it. What are we gathered here for? And we tried, we began to have a conversation in 2011 when we had the so-called Bali principles, where the non-use of force, etc., is already within that principle. But then, as I said before, we chose to pause. We chose to pause, and then the others came with the idea. And now, I guess it's better late than never that ASEAN is beginning to look at it. But I hope that ASEAN will have a very honest and a very thorough discussion of the geopolitics, the dynamics of the issue. There's not a one-size-fits-all. There is no magic wand. But I believe, personally, that we need to be looking at the dynamics of power in our region, not the balance of power, in terms of what makes country, the motivation and their outlook must be clarified, the trust deficit between countries of the region, the absence of crisis management capacity. This morning I read some article about how the United States vessels was involved in some kind of almost an incident situation in the South China Sea with Chinese naval forces. We need to prevent this kind of incidents developing to become a major crisis. We are absent of any crisis management capacity in our region. And this, notwithstanding the tremendous plethora of mechanism and forum that we have, when all is said and done, when things happen, no one really knows who is going to deal with it. That's why in the past I have asked, I've called for having a Peace and Security Council of the East Asia Summit that meets on a permanent basis, that can discuss any issues that they wish of the region, and also called on this Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation for the Indo-Pacific region, of East Asia, non-use of force among the East Asia Summit member states. Those, I think, in a way, addresses the issue of trust deficit, the issue of unintended conflict arising out of crisis. But those are just some thoughts. But there are other possibilities. But I just hope that ASEAN, in coming up with an Indo-Pacific outlook or idea, goes beyond simply drafting a declaration for the next summit of East Asia Summit to adopt a declaration, to say da-da-da-da-da-da again. No, we need something that's a bit more actionable, a bit more relevant. We need solution to the real problems, not solution to a non-problem, simply to have something to say. Mm-hmm. But it's great, tremendous to see, though, finally, that ASEAN is now beginning to take up the issue again. Mm-hmm. In the last summit, the last ASEAN foreign ministers meeting that I saw, the East Asia Summit outcome speaks of various concepts, in plural, various Indo-Pacific concepts, recognizing that there are so many out there. When in 2014, we were the only one, we were the early bird. ASEAN was the only one that had an idea, that had a vision on it. But now mm-hmm. it's a congested discussion, and ASEAN must deliver beyond those generalities, open, rules-based, and things of that type. What do you actually mean by Indo-Pacific?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Staying with this theme about the transformative power of ASEAN and the importance of the norms that ASEAN brings to the table and how those norms can evolve in positive ways. You talk about a number of cases in your book where you and others pushed for a more nuanced interpretation of the norm of non-interference and really to put a people-centered ASEAN and the norms of democracy and human rights more on the table. And that came to the fore in a number of cases, most notably perhaps the Myanmar case of support for Myanmar's democratic transition. We're now in a period where, there's a lot of talk about kind of backsliding in the region on democracy and human rights. A number of countries seem to not be moving sort of backwards on those front. Cambodia, perhaps Thailand, Philippines with some human rights issues, et cetera. So, your overall view in the book comes across as so nicely balanced between optimism of ASEAN's resilience and a real hard-nosed caution about the dangers of complacency and not moving forward. And so I wonder where you think ASEAN is now in terms of its ability to implement some of those people-centered norms to support what's seems to be a little bit of a backward trajectory, but is there hope for ASEAN supporting a movement of countries in a more positive way?
This is it's a process, it's not an event. The development of capacity of ASEAN in areas hitherto neglected by ASEAN, namely on internal governance issues, human rights, and democratization, requires a great deal of comfort level, a great deal of trust building between ASEAN member states. But it has to the process has to begin. It has to begin sometime. And we did in 2005 when we began with 2000 with the ASEAN political security community. And in the book, I did mention how actually all of us in ASEAN member states brought something to the table. We were all collectively part of a dynamic, changing state practice building experience. Mm-hmm. Indonesia had so many internal problems that we can choose to share with our ASEAN colleagues without their insistence, without their demand, or not at their behest. But we chose to bring it, these issues to ASEAN's discourse to change the dynamics, to say that it's actually perfectly fine to bring up, to bring our own internal problems to ASEAN because we are one big family. And Indonesia's initiation was met with similar response by the Philippines that began to share with us developments in the southern Philippines, in, by Thailand, in the southern Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, of course, over its seven-step roadmap, etc. Mm-hmm. But that required a certain type of leadership, certain type of hand-holding and purposeful attempt. But unfortunately, it requires that rather than simply adoption of declarations. But now what we are having now, I think, is we have the wherewithal, we have the potential. You know, you should, when one reads the ASEAN Human Rights Declaration, one is impressed by how comprehensive and how tremendously important that document is. I mean, I wish we just go by that alone. That's something that we ASEAN member states, our leaders have actually adopted. No one is imposing on anything on anyone. It's our, one of our own documents. It's not to do with the UN, etc. But even then, the gap between aspiration and reality is becoming wider and wider. Mm-hmm. And one needs only to look at regions such as in North Africa, Middle East, where changes, internal changes in countries like Syria, etc., have brought forth conflict at the national level, regional level, and global level to remind how important it is for ASEAN to develop these capacities. Mm-hmm. Because most of the transformative changes in ASEAN countries, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in Myanmar even, have taken place peacefully without any geopolitical repercussions. And this is not by accident. Rather, it's because of ASEAN providing the conditions conducive. But we need to maintain that statecraft, that finesse to be able to manage it. If we go into an either-or silo outlook, then we will find ourselves in a difficult state. Yeah.
And, we're here in Washington with a lot of former and perhaps current officials. So, of course, we're always thinking very specifically about what can the United States do to help strengthen ASEAN, to maintain ASEAN centrality. I think most people in Washington agree with the view that ASEAN centrality is actually extremely important to maintaining regional stability and that kind of bulwark against destabilization in a variety of ways. So what can the United States do to help, both in the broad sense of sort of a whole of government approach, if there are particular things the United States can do or is doing that's helpful? And then more specifically, President Trump went to the summits last year, met with his ASEAN counterparts, has announced he's not going this year. There's a sort of debate in this town about how important that is, whether that's going to have any impact. I'm surprised at the debate, frankly. In my view, it's tremendously important for the leader to show up. And when you have engagement, as President Obama showed in Sunnylands, to my mind, that's the most valuable thing the United States can do to help kind of bolster ASEAN and do whatever it can to kind of help forge a little bit of consensus. But I know there are other views about that, so I'm interested in your view.
Well, the United States' presence and engagement in the region and with ASEAN in particular is of great importance in the region's peace and stability. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we were discussing the prospect of the United States joining the East Asia Summit towards 2011, there was a more procedural debate and discussion going on whether the US, any U.S. president can make commitment to have an annual visit to the region, going back and forth. But thankfully, that type of more mechanical procedural debate and discussion was set aside when one recognizes how important it is for the United States to be engaged with the region. But the nature of the engagement, I think, is where I think a great deal of thought must go into this, because in some cases, it may surprise some, less can be more in the case of the United States. I think the best way have been for the United States to support ASEAN, to give us space for ASEAN, and to allow ASEAN to be taking the lead in setting up to set up the region's norms and principles, and the United States have, I think, on the whole, benefited from that type of approach. But with the rising China, with the different type of dynamics that is now taking place in the region, of course, everything is looked at from that China-US prism. When United States is less, it is assumed as if China is more, rather than it is giving ASEAN space. The absence of President Trump in the forthcoming summit could be problematic in the sense of the kind of message he's sending in terms of the importance that the United States is attaching to the region. But at the same time, in this time, uncertain times, benign neglect may not necessarily be a bad thing. In terms of the person of the president, not the United States, because I have a tremendous confidence in the way the professional service, the State Departments and defense and all the like that knows the region well, putting things on automatic pilot may not be a bad idea. But of course, leaders matter, leadership matters. The fact that President Trump will be absent in the region will be obviously speaking point, a point for people to be mulling over, but you know we wouldn't want that to take away from the reality of continued U.S. engagement in our region, in my view. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, let's open it up to questions from the audience. We will pass around. I'll start with Bob Blake. We'll pass you a microphone, and if you could introduce yourself, Bob, and ask
I'm Bob Blake. Former ambassador in Indonesia. I had the great honor to work with Foreign Minister Nadalagawa. And I really have, first I'd like to just praise you, Marty, for all the great work you did. I mean,
Thank you, sir. You really did, as Amy
said, you brought great energy and vision and leadership to your position that often is missing now in ASEAN, quite frankly. And that's really the question I'd like to ask. As I sit here the last 2 years, having returned from Indonesia, I sort of see that the situation in many ways is getting worse. And we're seeing a shrinking of democratic space. We've got the Rohingya crisis. We've got continued problems in the South China Sea and many, many other problems. And at the same time, we're seeing a real lack of leadership, not just in ASEAN, but frankly in the United States. President Trump has really circumscribed what we're going to do on issues like those, you know, democracy, on refugees. We've pulled back on our commitments, not just in ASEAN, but UNRWA and things like that as well, which many of us regret. And the EU, you know, is still, I think, active, but you know, they too are very circumscribed about what they can do, for example, on refugees, because they've got their own Mediterranean problems of the Libyans and the Syrians and the sub-Saharan Africans who are all descending on EU shores. So in many ways, one could argue that this is ASEAN's moment to step up and do something. And you know, I think on two issues in particular, the Rohingya crisis and the South China Sea, we've got 700,000 refugees in very, very poor Bangladesh and really no solution in sight. And Indonesia in the past, including now, I think Foreign Minister Marsudi has been quite active. But I think that that whole situation could benefit from more leadership and frankly, a little bit, something with a little bit more teeth in it to talk, quite frankly, with Myanmar and your fellow ASEAN state about possible solutions to this. And, you know, they talk about repatriation, but none of those 700,000 refugees want to go back to Myanmar right now. They don't feel it's safe. So there's got to be sort of a conditions-based approach. And I think, frankly, ASEAN and Indonesia are in a much better position to talk about those kind of issues than we are, or the EU or other countries. So that's one. Mm-hmm. On the South China Sea, likewise. I mean, I think as the last 2 years have shown that China is continuing its development of the islands, a lot of scholars now say that China's ultimate objective is to bring both Hong Kong and the South China Sea under its dominion, complete dominion, by 2049. And frankly, the code of conduct is kind of not moving ahead very rapidly. Mm. So again, a really terrific opportunity for both ASEAN and perhaps Indonesia to really step forward and do something, because in many ways, it's a lot easier for you to work on these issues than it will be for the United States to try to impose some sort of solution. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about those two specific issues, you know, where you see hope for progress. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ambassador. Earlier, I spoke of the challenge by ASEAN, among others, is really to strike equilibrium between the domestic and internal and external nexus, as well as the regional and global nexus. And I think that the two cases that you highlight are illustrative of that challenge, both litmus tests for ASEAN. In the first one, the case of Rohingya in the Rakhine state of Myanmar, a classic case of how ASEAN matter or not matter in dealing with internal situation within its member states. Purely domestic internal issues, development, but having obviously regional ramifications for obvious reasons. Can we be of relevance on this portfolio? On the South China Sea, again, a litmus test in terms of the region and beyond the region. Mm-hmm. How ASEAN manages relationship with major powers, China, United States, etc. Can we deliver? And actually on both, we had a script. We had scripts for those. On Myanmar, even before the most recent Rohingya crisis, the entire Myanmar transition process, ASEAN had a script and actually deliberately and purposely followed that script. We were united vis-a-vis the rest of the world, but we were extremely, and I must emphasize, and I hope my book does justice to it, we were extremely candid and quite persistent in pushing Myanmar to deliver. They can't have it both ways. They can't expect ASEAN to be providing unity externally and yet within they stand still. So we were pushing and encouraging Myanmar to deliver, to undertake the type of transformation that it promises to itself, and we were united. But now I think, and for that to happen, it requires trust by Myanmar of ASEAN. Indonesia, I think, has been extremely important because whether it's correct or incorrect, I'm not sure, but certainly the authorities back then saw Indonesia in a quite similar way, having similar experience, a country with a great deal of ethnic diversity, a prominent role, for example, to the armed forces. But there was a comparison to be drawn and lessons to be shared. But there was confidence and trust and comfort level for us to be conversing with them in a good way. I'm not sure where we are now because I'm not privy to the current dynamics, but I get a little bit troubled when I see a statement, most recent statement by ASEAN saying, well, the responsibility is now also on Myanmar to do certain things, ASEAN, externalizing Myanmar from ASEAN itself. But Myanmar is ASEAN. ASEAN is Myanmar. They are one of us. You can't put them out and say, you know, you have to do this, because when we point to them, we are really pointing to ourselves. I get a little bit concerned when we have all these dignitaries visiting the, is it Bazar Cox? In the Bangladesh side of the border, expressing concern of the, how come these leaders are not in Myanmar itself? Myanmar can be receiving all type of dignitaries from all over the world, except from ASEAN leaders. There is a disconnect here. Perfectly divided at the United Nations. I can only describe, because I'm not within the dynamics, but I'm troubled by how it is that we end up in this spot. I wish this situation can be better addressed, because it is clearly a litmus test on ASEAN, the way whether we can have a solution, a roadmap for dealing with the nexus between domestic and external. And because if we get it right, this is a worthwhile investment, because there will be more to come in not in Myanmar, but in other parts of Southeast Asia. We have similar situation plenty, and therefore developing capacity in this area is extremely important. On the South China Sea, it has been, I remember, as I described in the book, back in the early 90s when we began to speak of the South China Sea through the so-called South China Sea Workshop, which was one of my first diplomatic assignments. I remember many diplomats in Southeast Asia, in ASEAN, saying, this is Indonesia being busybody, trying to find new problems after Cambodian conflict when there is not really a problem there. But we were trying to be transformative. We were trying to be anticipative. But then things developed the way it has. And therefore, 2002, 2012, we have had an ASEAN, China, DOC, etc. But again, we had a script, but then we sort of we lost the script again. And this is what frustrates me a little bit, because now I'm told, and people are celebrating to say that we've had this consolidated draft on the COC recently noted at the ASEAN Foreign Ministers meeting in Singapore. I'm not obviously privy to the document, and I wouldn't want to be privy to it, because it is a confidential document. But from reports that I came across, it is suggested that there are positions within the COC, square bracketed, by country A, country B, country C of ASEAN. Now, to me, that is quite not helpful to have a position by China and position by the 10 ASEAN member states individually identified in that way, because we have been working in the past of having a collective ASEAN 10 position vis-a-vis China. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, a type of approach and modalities. Sometimes this type of things, divisions or dynamics, is best to be kept in one's own memory bank rather than to have it fleshed out on a piece of paper, because they tend to be, as you know, Ambassador, tend to be then cast in stone, almost like becomes even more difficult to find solutions. But you are quite right on both on the Myanmar issue and on the South China Sea, litmus test for ASEAN. Leadership, not simply leaders, leadership is needed, and I'm hopeful that the ASEAN can deliver. Ibu Menteri Luar Negeri, Ibu Retno, have been extremely proactive and active, especially on the Rohingya issue, and I'm sure she will continue to be doing so. Yeah.
Other questions? This gentleman here.
Hello, sir. Appreciate your time. My name is Matthew Gross. I'm a student over at SAIS. And a quick question just regarding China. I think you can point to some recent examples in the past where China has gone around ASEAN and worked bilaterally with nations like Philippines, with Malaysia. I'd just be curious to hear your thoughts on if there's a concern that China is subverting ASEAN, if rendering ASEAN impotent in a sense. Thank you for your time.
Well, the ASEAN has always, throughout its existence, been subject to the push and pull of major powers, right? Now we are all focused on China, but all throughout, this is not actually a new phenomenon. ASEAN actually has never pretended to have a unified foreign policy outlook. You know, within ASEAN, you have countries that are obviously having special relationship in the United States, for instance, others close to China, others chose to be non-aligned, and like Indonesia. So the variation, I didn't use the term division, but the variation in foreign policy outlook within ASEAN in the past have not been inimical, have not been prohibitive to ASEAN having common position. It's only recently, I have to say, that we have ASEAN again begun to lose the capacity to have a little bit more depth management of these dynamics, as if you have to put all your lot in one basket or the other. And China obviously have a tremendous instruments to be cajoling and to be encouraging member states of ASEAN to adopt certain outlook. And in this case is where the notion of an a la carte ASEAN must be addressed, because at the moment, in the absence of a solid and unified ASEAN position, countries will look for security and prosperity elsewhere, and ASEAN will be dissected in the way that it is now becoming increasingly apparently the case. So China is a fact of life in its prominence, but ASEAN must learn to manage that. That's why in the book I use the term striking a dynamic equilibrium between all these different powers that are in the region, not to put our lot with one side or the other, but to ensure that ASEAN be indispensable in the management of the power dynamics in our region. But again, this requires, like on human rights and on democracy, a great deal of thorough, constant, and purposeful efforts. Once ASEAN switch off, then we will be where we will be. Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, I think we have time for one more question. The gentleman here. Oh, I think we do need a microphone for the please have the microphone because we are live streaming. So
my name is Gerald Heng, and I came from London and Boston, Massachusetts, New England. Your Excellency, selamat datang.
Terima kasih, Pak.
Ke Washington D.C. ini. ASEAN as a concept has been developed as a mission,
yes,
somewhat like the European Union, the European Common Market. And when ASEAN was formed, all the member states knew from the time of Bang Sukarno that they cannot be dispassionate. They have to be passionate. They have to have the passion to make that ASEAN into a concept that is a moving economic entity. Because since the time that the ringgit, the rupiah, and the dollar has become the net worth measure of human race, that has become the concept. But right now, we enter into a new era, an era of the future. China is now reconnecting Asia and ASEAN with their Belt and Road Initiative. And they put in a lot of money on infrastructure and so on and so on and so on. But it doesn't follow that all the member states of ASEAN would react positively. Mm-hmm. For example, Malaysia has already kicked out the Road and Belt Initiative with billions of dollars invested in updating the railway system with bullet train and so on. So, Ambassador, please tell us whether the Chinese concept of road and belt would eventually turn out to be imperialism for ASEAN.
Well, thank you very much. what a way to end our session. the point that I wanted to make, akin to the Indo-Pacific one, is how to remind actually how ASEAN itself, even prior to One Belt, One Road, we have a script on connectivity. It's called the ASEAN Master Plan for ASEAN connectivity. In other words, within ASEAN, we've had a long discourse on how we need to be developing our connectivity, both physical as well as non-physical, to ensure that our economies are even more integrated, even more connected. But things happen because we weren't as persistent, we weren't as committed in implementing our own plans then China developed its own vision, the One Belt, One Road vision. And that has become, has obtained a great deal of currency, a great deal of attention. And in a way, the ASEAN's own master plan have been set aside. But what makes it worse to me is that how there is not a common ASEAN position on One Belt, One Road. You know, you mentioned about the example of Malaysia, but other ASEAN member states individually have welcomed the initiative, others less welcoming, others a bit neutral. But there is not one common ASEAN, to my knowledge, I stand to be corrected, one common ASEAN outlook on One Belt, One Road. Everyone is going a la carte, they're trying to strike a deal with China on their own, when in fact, if we rework collective and common in our outlook, we simply bring to the Chinese side, this is our own master plan vision. Let's ensure that there is synergy, there is complementarity in our outlook and efforts, rather than us being dissected by China in this case. So we need to have respect and to have consistency in the very initiatives that we have begun, whether it be in the Pacific, the ASEAN Master Plan for ASEAN Connectivity. Thankfully, RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, thankfully is still out there. Because I remember there was a time with all the attention on the TPP, RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, was set at the, was sidelined a little bit. It was only when the current administration chose to withdraw from the TPP, then RCEP's currency began to become a bit more relevant. But that RCEP is ASEAN's own initiative. So the moral of the story, the point that I wanted to make is that we need to have our own vision. We need to have our own plan, common vision, outlook, and not simply, attach our interest, put all our eggs in someone else's basket, but develop our own capacity and outlook. But having said all that, I mean the point that I was trying to make in the book that I have is that this is it's not meant to celebrate ASEAN's achievements, because I feel it a little bit awkward to be doing so, because I was very much part of what ASEAN has been doing. So I leave the achievements for others to reflect, far more objective and far more capable to be doing so. But what I had meant to identify in the book is what remains to be done, things that I didn't manage to get done. I mean, things like I speak there of the admission of Timor-Leste to ASEAN, a huge shortcoming on my part. I mean, I wish I had got it done, because I feel there was a window there that I really wanted to get it done. I failed as well. I was short in terms of getting the nuclear weapon states on board for the Southeast Asian nuclear weapon free zone. I thought there was a window there, but I missed it again. So the book is about not celebrating the successes, but more owning up to say, look, there are so many things that's left undone, left to be done. For ASEAN leaders, ASEAN future generations to take up. So it's that is the spirit. And it is only a view within the region, within ASEAN. Because one thing for sure in ASEAN, whenever you have a discussion, there is always robust discussion, and visions are often not the same. There are variation, division sometimes. But ultimately, when we have an agreement, we can, rally around that agreement. But that is the trust and the sentiment behind the book. And I hope those who read the book will find it useful, not to, recollect on the past, but more recognizing what remains to be done. That's the intention. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your historically based, historically informed, fact-based, and very thoughtful analysis and insights on ASEAN and broader regional dynamics with us today. Once again, the book is for sale in the back. I hope you all pick up a copy. It really is a terrific read. And
thank you,
Marty, so much. Please join me in thanking Dr. Natalegawa.